Imagine building like a 100-story mega hotel right in the middle of a major city.
Okay, a massive skyscraper.
Right, a total skyscraper. And from the outside, the public is just looking at the billions of dollars being poured into the concrete, the glass, the endless construction crews.
And they're probably thinking it's a huge waste of money.
Exactly. They scream, you know, this is a massive boondoggle. You will never, ever fill 100 floors of hotel rooms every single night.
Which, to be fair, is a logical assumption if you don't know the internal math.
Yes, but what if that internal math of the developer proves that they only need to rent out the bottom 13 floors to completely pay the mortgage, cover the staff, and just break even on the entire colossal structure?
Meaning everything from floor 14 all the way up to 100 is just pure profit.
Exactly. Everything else is gravy. And today we're applying that exact mathematical framework to the artificial intelligence boom. Because, you know, you look at the news and you see these staggering multi-trillion-dollar numbers being thrown around for data centers, power grids, silicon.
It's enough to make anyone's head spin.
It really is. And it is entirely natural for you, the listener, to sit back right now and wonder if we are living inside the biggest tech bubble in human history.
I mean, it is basically the defining financial and technological question of our time right now.
Right.
And the reason people feel that vertigo, that sense of impending collapse, is because the numbers are so large, they literally break our traditional mental models of how corporate spending is supposed to work.
They just don't compute for a normal business.
No, they don't. When you see companies spending hundreds of billions of dollars on physical infrastructure before the consumer applications even fully exist, well, the historical reflex is to just assume it's a bubble.
Okay, let's unpack this, because today's deep dive is absolutely not about hype. We are setting all the vibes and the science fiction totally aside.
Good, because there is way too much of that out there.
Way too much. We are not guessing what a chatbot or like a humanoid robot might be able to do in a decade. We are looking at a highly detailed stack of financial models, hyperscaler earnings reports, and infrastructure capacity forecasts.
And we're talking heavy hitters here, right?
Oh, absolutely. Bessemer, McKinsey, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan. The mission for the next hour is to reverse engineer the actual literal math of the AI boom. We are going to calculate the physical limit of AI revenue by the year 2030 to see if this astronomical spending is mathematically justified.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, what we are doing today is basically shifting our perspective from a demand thesis to a capacity thesis.
A capacity thesis. Break that down for us.
Yeah. So when a new technology arrives, our first instinct is to measure the demand. Like how many people are logging in? How many enterprise licenses are actually being sold?
Which makes sense for traditional software.
Right. But right now, in the age of AI, theoretical demand vastly outstrips the physical supply. When demand is essentially infinite, or at least, you know, far larger than what can currently be serviced, trying to measure it is a fool's errand. You have to calculate the choke points instead.
I really love that framing. We are not measuring the hype, we are measuring the choke points.
Exactly.
And the ultimate choke point, it isn't a line of code. It isn't some fancy algorithm. It's physical power. We are talking about literal gigawatts of electricity.
The heavy physical stuff.
Yes. And according to the data we have from Bessemer Venture Partners, as of early 2026, there are 190 gigawatts of hyperscale data center capacity announced across 777 projects globally.
To truly grasp the scale of that number, we have to look at what a gigawatt actually represents in the real world.
Right, because most people don't deal in gigawatts on a daily basis.
No, of course not. So a single gigawatt of power is roughly equivalent to the energy consumption of a medium-sized city.
Like how big of a city are we talking?
Like San Francisco.
Wow.
Yeah. So an announced pipeline of 190 gigawatts is the equivalent of planning to build the power draw of 190 new San Franciscos purely to run computation.
That is just mind-blowing.
It is a foundational rewiring of global energy consumption. AI is simply the most power-intensive workload in the entire history of computing.
But having a pipeline on paper is, you know, very different from having that power actually flowing into servers.
No, very different.
Because if we break down that 190 gigawatt number, reality starts to hit you in the face pretty fast. Out of that 190 gigawatts, approximately 148 gigawatts are strictly in the planning stages.
It's blueprints right now.
Exactly. About 21 gigawatts are currently under construction. And only 12 gigawatts of that specific announced pipeline are actually operational today.
Which is a tiny fraction.
It really is. To put that in perspective, the total current global capacity for all AI data centers right now is roughly 30 gigawatts.
And this brings us right to the critical bottleneck. Because the physical construction of a data center, you know, pouring the concrete, erecting the steel, installing the massive liquid cooling systems, and racking all the servers, that can actually be done relatively quickly.
Right, they've gotten pretty good at building the actual shells.
Yeah, a hyperscaler can stand up a physical shell in about 12 to 18 months. But connecting that building to the national power grid, that is an entirely different beast.
That's where things grind to a halt.
Exactly. The data shows that grid connection currently takes anywhere from 5 to 7 years.
5 to 7 years just to plug the building in?
Yep.
I mean, if you are listening to this and thinking, wait, why on earth does it take half a decade to plug a building into the wall?
Right.
We have to look at the mechanisms of the power grid. It is not just about running a long extension cord.
Far from it. You are dealing with the actual physics of high voltage electricity here.
Yeah.
To safely draw that much power from the grid without causing, say, rolling blackouts in the surrounding region, you need massive new substations.
Like whole new pieces of infrastructure.
Right. You need high voltage transmission lines. You need these highly specialized house-sized electrical transformers.
House-sized?
Literally the size of a house. And currently, there is a massive global supply chain shortage for those specific high-voltage transformers.
So you can't even buy them if you want to.
No, the queue to simply purchase one is literally years long. Furthermore, the existing electrical grid in places like the U.S. was simply not designed for a single corporate facility to draw the power of a major municipality 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
And beyond the physics and the supply chain, you have the human element, right? Because the data shows a really significant local opposition factor emerging.
NIMB is a real bottleneck here.
Exactly. In the U.S. alone, roughly 8% to 10% of these massive data center projects are facing severe delays or outright cancellation just because of pushback from local communities.
People get nervous when a facility like that comes to town.
Naturally. They are worried about the strain on their local power rates, the immense amount of water required for cooling these servers, and just the sheer physical footprint of the facilities.
It creates a fascinating and honestly somewhat absurd geopolitical reality.
How so?
Well, the limiting factor for the deployment of the most advanced technology in human history isn't the availability of advanced silicon chips. And it isn't the ingenuity of software engineers in Silicon Valley.
Right.
The limiting factor is literally a local zoning board in a suburb deciding whether or not to approve a new substation.
That is wild when you put it like that. But I have to push back on this timeline a bit because the numbers from the heavy hitters seem to totally contradict this reality.
Let's hear it.
You look at McKinsey and Goldman Sachs, and they were projecting that global AI data center capacity will hit somewhere between 220 gigawatts and 327 gigawatts by the year 2030.
Those are massive projections.
Right. If we are currently at roughly 30 gigawatts globally, that is a massive 9x increase in capacity over just 4.5 years. So how is a 9x increase physically possible if we just establish that a grid connection takes 7 years?
That is the central tension of this entire industry right now. And the answer is that the major technology companies, these hyperscalers, they are not going to patiently wait in a 7-year queue for the U.S. grid to modernize.
They can't afford to wait.
No. If the domestic grid is the bottleneck, capital and infrastructure will flow like water to the path of least resistance. We are already seeing these companies look outside their traditional hubs.
Where are they going?
Well, they're looking at regions like the Middle East, for example.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, because governments there are highly motivated to diversify away from oil. And they can offer abundant, rapidly accessible power with far, far less regulatory friction.
So they basically skip the zoning board entirely.
Precisely. They are also exploring stranded power assets like locations where power is currently generated but severely underutilized.
So, to use an analogy, it's like trying to measure the ocean by looking at the water, when what we really should be doing is looking at the size of the bathtub we are trying to fill.
That's a great way to look at it.
The software demand doesn't matter if the physical concrete and copper wire aren't there to carry it. The capacity constraint is the absolute only metric that truly dictates the speed of the revolution.
And what McKinsey and Goldman are essentially telling us is that the bathtub is going to expand from 30 units today to potentially 327 units by 2030.
Which is an incredibly expensive bathtub.
Unbelievably expensive. To build that kind of infrastructure requires a staggering $5.2 trillion in total compute infrastructure investment.
Which naturally leads us to the multi-trillion dollar question.
Wow.
How do you actually pay for a $5.2 trillion build-out? Because just pouring concrete and drawing gigawatts of power doesn't pay dividends on its own.
It just burns cash.
Exactly. We have to figure out how the industry turns that raw physical power into actual dollars. We need to establish the physical revenue ceiling of this entire endeavor.
And to establish a revenue ceiling, we need a baseline metric. We need a real-world proven example of exactly how much money a single gigawatt of AI compute can generate when a frontier model is actually running at scale.
So we aren't just guessing?
Right. No guesswork. And in our source material, the clearest benchmark we have for this conversion rate right now is Anthropic.
Okay, let's walk through the math on Anthropic step by step, because this is where the abstract concepts turn into hard, undeniable economics.
Walk us through it.
So Anthropic recently reported an annualized revenue run rate that surpassed $30 billion. Now, to generate that $30 billion in software revenue, they operate on an estimated physical compute footprint of roughly 1.4 to 1.9 gigawatts.
So the arithmetic here is incredibly illuminating.
It really is.
Because if you take their $30 billion in revenue and you simply divide it by that 1.4 to 1.9 gigawatt footprint, you arrive at a highly specific monetization metric.
Which comes out to what?
It yields roughly $15.7 billion to $21.4 billion in revenue per gigawatt year.
That's huge.
It is. That is the current real-world conversion rate of raw electricity into artificial intelligence revenue.
Okay, let's take that conversion rate. Let's just call it a conservative $15 billion per gigawatt for easy math and apply it to that massive bathtub we just measured.
Let's do it.
If the total global capacity by 2030 is estimated to reach between 220 and 327 gigawatts, and each of those gigawatts has the potential to generate $15 to $21 billion, we are looking at a physical revenue ceiling for the entire AI industry of between $3.3 trillion and $6.8 trillion every single year by 2030.
Every single year.
The mid-range of that is approximately $5
trillion. $5 trillion in annual revenue capacity. I mean, it is a number so large it almost feels fictional, doesn't it?
Yes, it feels completely made up.
But it is deeply grounded in the physical realities of the infrastructure we just laid out.
Mm.
And we can actually cross-reference this revenue potential against the physical costs to understand the underlying profitability.
Okay, how do we do that?
Let's look at the landmark agreement between Anthropic and Amazon Web Services. Anthropic committed over $100 billion over a 10-year period to secure up to 5 gigawatts of capacity from Amazon.
Let's slow that down and break it apart for a second. Right. $100 billion over 10 years for 5 gigawatts.
Exactly. So if you divide that $100 billion by 10 years, that gives you $10 billion a year.
Right.
Then divide that $10 billion by the 5 gigawatts they secured, and you find that the compute lease cost, basically the cost to rent the physical infrastructure, is roughly $2 billion per gigawatt year.
Wait, I want to make sure you, the listener, are grasping the magnitude of this spread. Anthropic is paying Amazon $2 billion to lease a gigawatt of power and servers for a single year.
Yes.
But based on their current run rate, they are generating between $15 billion and $21 billion in revenue from that exact same gigawatt.
That is the absolute magic of the business model. The spread between the physical cost of the compute and the value of the intelligence generated by that compute is just massive.
It's an incredible markup.
It is. This is exactly why the gross margins in this space are so incredibly high. Currently, Anthropic's reported gross margins are hovering around 77%.
Wow.
And if you model this out, assuming that, you know, premium pricing for these frontier models holds and compute lease costs remain the dominant cost of goods sold, well, there is a very real upside scenario where those gross margins could eventually converge on 90%.
90%.
Yeah. You are looking at elite software-like profitability layered directly on top of heavy, capital-intensive physical infrastructure.
Okay, I hear that, and the math is amazing. But I have to play devil's advocate here for a second, because I'm sure you listening at home are thinking the exact same thing right now.
Hit me.
Anthropic is a highly specific, cutting-edge, frontier AI company. They are building some of the most advanced models in the entire world. They are certainly not going to own all 327 gigawatts of the world's compute.
No, definitely not.
So is it really analytically safe to take this single elite company's revenue per gigawatt metric, and just blanket apply it across the entire global infrastructure.
Yeah.
I mean, not every single company using AI compute is going to have the pricing power or the efficiency of an Anthropic.
That is a crucial distinction to make, and I'm glad you brought it up. And it is precisely why we refer to that $3.3 trillion, $6.8 trillion figure as a revenue ceiling, not a guarantee.
Right. It's a best case scenario.
Exactly. It represents the maximum upper bound of what the infrastructure is physically capable of yielding, assuming it is optimized to the level of a frontier model.
Which won't always be the case.
No. In reality, significant portions of that future capacity will be utilized for much lower margin tasks, things like routine inference, internal enterprise data processing, or just hosting open source models that don't command massive premium subscription fees.
But setting that ceiling is still vital, right? Because
right.
It anchors the entire conversation in physical reality.
100%.
You cannot evaluate whether technology is in a financial bubble unless you know what the maximum potential payout could theoretically be. We know the absolute physical maximum the industry could make is around $5 trillion a year.
But a ceiling just tells us what is theoretically possible if everything goes perfectly.
Right. The real question, the test that determines if this entire ecosystem is going to just collapse under its own weight, is how much of that theoretical capacity they actually need to sell just to survive.
Yes. This is what we call the execution hurdle. To figure out the minimum execution required to avoid a totally catastrophic financial disaster, we look to the financial institutions that actually model these required returns on capital.
Who are we looking at for this?
JP Morgan, for instance, has run the numbers on the current capital expenditures.
Yeah.
They estimate that the AI industry needs to generate roughly $650 billion in annual revenue by 2030 just to financially justify the massive amounts of money being spent today.
So $650 billion.
But then Bain & Company takes a much more aggressive stance. They set a much higher hurdle, estimating that the scaling of AI could require up to $2 trillion in annual revenue by 2030 to really validate the investments.
Okay, so let's run this execution test. Let's pit these hurdles against our $5 trillion mid-range capacity ceiling.
The math gets fun here.
It does. If JP Morgan's $650 billion hurdle is the accurate requirement, that means the industry only needs to successfully monetize about 13% of its physical capacity to completely justify the costs.
Just 13%.
Yeah. And even if we use Bain's much more aggressive $2 trillion hurdle, the industry only needs to hit a roughly 39% execution rate.
This mathematical reality completely reframes the whole public narrative. Because when commentators and skeptics go on TV and yell bubble, they are implicitly assuming that everything has to go flawlessly for these tech giants to make their money back.
They act like it's all or nothing.
Exactly. They assume the margin for error is essentially zero. But the underlying math shows that the physical capacity they are building is so incredibly vast and the revenue per gigawatt potential is so incredibly high that they only need to succeed on 13% to 39% of their total footprint just to break even and satisfy return requirements.
Let's go back to the mega hotel analogy from the very beginning of the deep dive. When you understand that you only need to rent out the bottom 13 floors of a 100-story building to pay for the whole thing, the risk profile completely changes.
You have an enormous 87-floor margin of safety built right in.
Right. But here is the reality check. You still have to find enough guests to actually fill those bottom 13 floors. You still need actual paying demand to utilize that baseline supply. So what does the math say about the demand required to fill those floors?
Well, if we were expanding global capacity by roughly 9x over a 4.5-year period to hit that 2030 target, the laws of compounding dictate a very specific growth requirement.
What's the target?
The math shows that user demand must grow by approximately 63% annualized just to maintain 100% utilization of the newly constructed capacity as it comes online.
63% annual growth. I mean, in any traditional industry like automobiles, retail, even traditional software, a sustained 63% annual growth requirement would be virtually impossible.
It would be a massive flashing red flag.
Yeah, it really would. But AI is obviously not behaving like a traditional industry. Let's look at the actual demand reality right now. The fundamental unit of measure for AI demand is the token.
Right, which is essentially just a piece of a word or the basic unit of data that a model processes.
Exactly. And currently, global token demand is doubling every 104 days.
The scale of that token growth is honestly difficult to comprehend.
It's exponential.
It is. Google actually recently provided a rare look under the hood of their infrastructure. They disclosed they are processing 3.2 quadrillion tokens every single month.
Quadrillion. With a Q.
With a Q. That represents a 330 times increase in token volume in just 2 years. And even in Google's most incredibly conservative internal modeling for future token growth, they are projecting a 7x annual increase.
A 7x annual increase translates to 600% annual growth. That is nearly 10 times higher than the 63% baseline floor required to fill those new data centers.
Massive overperformance.
And the source material points out something really vital here. This demand isn't just coming from humans sitting at a keyboard typing prompts into a browser.
No, and what's fascinating here is the fundamental shift in the nature of the end user. We are actively transitioning from human-prompted chatbots to autonomous AI agents and humanoid robots.
Which changes everything.
It really does. Bank of America's data provides a pretty wild glimpse into this shift. Yeah. They estimate that the installed base of humanoid robots will grow from roughly 20,000 today to 10 million by the year 2035.
10 million physical robots.
Yeah, that implies an 86% annual growth rate for robotics alone.
But, okay, why do physical robots or digital agents change the math on data center capacity so drastically?
It all comes down to the utilization rate.
How so?
Well, a human being might use an AI assistant for, you know, an hour or two a day to draft some emails or summarize a few documents. But a human needs to sleep. They eat, they log off, they go outside.
Sure.
A humanoid robot working on a factory assembly line or an autonomous digital agent running complex background cybersecurity analysis for a Fortune 500 company, they're operating 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
They never sleep.
Never. They're continuous, nonstop token-generating machines. They require a constant, heavy, unbroken stream of computation just to navigate the physical world or execute these complex, multi-step digital workflows. They represent a permanent, always-on baseline of immense compute demand.
But we have to be rigorous here. If you're listening and thinking critically, you are probably saying, wait a minute, tokens are not dollars.
And that's fair.
You cannot just magically map a 600% growth in token volume directly to a 600% growth in corporate revenue.
And you would be entirely correct to point that out. Tokens absolutely do not map to revenue on a perfect one-to-one basis.
Why not?
Because as the industry matures, the models naturally become more efficient. They require less compute to generate the exact same quality of output, which naturally drives the cost per token down.
So it gets cheaper for the user.
Right. Furthermore, you have the rise of reasoning models. A reasoning model might use a massive amount of internal compute shot, generating thousands of hidden tokens to basically think through a complex math or coding problem before it ever outputs a single word to the user.
Ah, I see.
And how you monetize those hidden reasoning tokens is very different from how you monetize standard text generation. Add in enterprise volume discounts, free tier usage for general consumers, and fluctuating energy costs. And that revenue per token metric becomes highly, highly variable.
But the core insight from the data here is the sheer size of the buffer, right? The gap between the 63% required growth to clear the execution hurdle and the 600% to 700% actual token growth we are witnessing is so massive that it provides an enormous cushion against all of those inefficiencies.
Exactly. Even if the revenue capture per token drops significantly due to efficiency gains or a price war, the raw volume expansion is still more than enough to clear that 13% execution hurdle. The psychology of the market really begins to shift when you fully understand that 13% floor. When you realize the margin of safety built into these multi-trillion dollar projections, that reflexive bubble narrative starts to look more like a failure to do basic arithmetic.
But modeling the future and projecting 2030 demand is one thing. To truly prove whether or not this is a bubble, we have to look at right now. We have to look at the actual cash hitting the bank accounts of these companies today.
Real cash, real profits.
Yes, which brings us to the most concrete evidence we have, the hyperscaler return on investment.
If you want to accurately diagnose a bubble, you have to look at exactly who is signing the checks. The spending in the AI boom is not evenly distributed across like thousands of speculative startups building pets.com equivalents. It is highly concentrated at the absolute top of the market. The hyperscalers, primarily the top four tech giants, so Amazon, Microsoft, Google, and Oracle, they account for roughly 75% to 80% of all global AI infrastructure spending.
And because these are massive publicly traded companies, we don't have to guess about their finances. We can see their audited, rigorously verified financial results every single quarter.
Every day.
And in their most recent quarters, these hyperscalers reported operating profit growth ranging between 20% and 33%.
Now, this is where the timeline of physical construction we discussed earlier becomes absolutely vital for our analysis.
Because of the lag.
Exactly. We are currently about 3.5 years into this specific AI boom.
Right.
We also established that it takes between 1 and 3 years to physically construct a data center, install the silicon, and actually bring it online to generate revenue.
Right.
Therefore, the 20% to 33% operating profit growth that these companies are reporting today is the direct realized financial return on the capital expenditures they made roughly 2 years ago.
So this isn't just a theory anymore. The billions of dollars they spent in, say, 2024 are generating 30% profit growth in 2026.
Precisely.
This is incredibly strong empirical evidence that their historical cash returns on invested capital, which for these elite companies usually hovers around a 20% return, are being fully maintained in the AI era. They are not throwing hundreds of billions of dollars into a speculative black hole.
No, they are building highly profitable cash-generating assets. It is the ultimate validation of the current business model. And it introduces perhaps the single most important concept in this entire deep dive.
What's that?
It is a concept called contracted scarcity.
Contracted scarcity.
Yeah. When Microsoft or Amazon breaks ground on a new billion-dollar AI data center, they are not building it on speculation. They're not acting like some speculative real estate developer building a random strip mall, hoping that a grocery store or a nail salon decides to lease a space once the building is finally finished.
All right. They are not building on hope.
Exactly. Across these major cloud providers, we look at a financial metric called RPO, which stands for Remaining Performance Obligations.
Break that down into plain English.
In plain English, RPO is their contracted backlog. It means an enterprise client, say a massive global bank or a pharmaceutical giant, has already signed a legally binding contract committing to buy a specific amount of compute over the next several years.
It's locked in.
It is locked in. And currently, the RPO across these major cloud providers exceeds $2
trillion. $2 trillion already spoken for.
And that backlog is growing at an astonishing rate of 80% to 115% year over year.
Contracted scarcity. That phrase is exactly why the CEOs of these tech giants sound so incredibly, almost unnervingly confident on their quarterly earnings call.
They don't sound worried at all.
Not at all. When you build infrastructure into contracted scarcity, the financial risk is dramatically lowered. You already know your margins before the concrete foundation is even poured. It is why a CEO can get on a microphone and confidently tell Wall Street that they expect 75% gross margins next quarter. They aren't guessing. The data center isn't built on a prayer. It's built because the check is essentially already in the mail.
Yep.
They know exactly how much compute they are selling. They know exactly which Fortune 500 company they are selling it to, and they know exactly what their energy and hardware costs are.
When you have a $2 trillion legally binding backlog of demand, your primary business risk fundamentally shifts. Mm. Your biggest threat is no longer a lack of customers.
What is it then?
Your biggest threat is operational failure. It's the inability to build the physical data centers fast enough to actually honor the contracts you've already signed.
Right.
That fear of breaching contracts and losing market share to a rival cloud provider is exactly why they're spending so aggressively on infrastructure right now.
Okay, I hear that, and the logic is totally sound. The data centers they built 2 years ago are highly profitable because they were built into this contracted scarcity, but I have to challenge this premise going forward.
Let's hear the challenge.
It is one thing to spend $50 billion and see a return, but we are looking at a massive $725 billion being spent by these hyperscalers this year alone. How can we be absolutely sure that the returns won't eventually diminish?
That's the million-dollar question.
Right. I mean, trees don't grow to the sky. Aren't we eventually going to hit a wall where the supply of data centers finally catches up to the enterprise demand, the pricing power drops, and the return on invested capital just collapses?
It is the exact right question to ask. And it is the primary risk factor that institutional investors are actively monitoring right now. We can never say with 100% certainty that returns won't eventually compress as the market matures and supply reaches an equilibrium with demand.
It's bound to happen eventually.
That is the natural life cycle of literally any new industry. However, the data we have right now, specifically the fact that the RPO backlog continues to grow at 80% to 115%, even as they spend hundreds of billions, strongly suggests that we have not yet reached that inflection point.
The demand is still outrunning the supply.
Yes. The evidence shows they are still building into deep, contracted scarcity today. To see where the broader market thinks this is heading, we really have to look at how Wall Street is pricing in these massive profits. Are investors pricing in an imminent collapse, or are they valuing these companies reasonably?
Which sets up our next major exploration beautifully, the valuation bridge illusion.
This is a fun one.
Because if you turn on the financial news networks or read the skeptical blogs out there, the tech bubble critics have a very specific, very famous historical analogy they love to wield like a club.
Oh, I know the one.
They always point back to the year 2000, to the absolute peak of the dot-com bubble, and they bring up the CEO of Sun Microsystems, Scott McNealy.
It is the classic textbook cautionary tale of financial exuberance. After the dot-com crash wiped out trillions in wealth, McNealy gave this famous interview warning investors that trading at 10 times sales was absolute mathematical insanity.
And his logic was pretty brutal.
His logic was brutal and perfectly mathematically sound for his specific business. He explained that to justify paying a multiple of 10 times gross sales, he would effectively have to pay out 100% of his company's revenues. Not profits, but every single dollar that came through the door as dividends to shareholders for a solid decade.
Which is impossible.
Right. Because that assumption required zero cost of goods sold, $0 spent on research and development, and zero taxes paid just for the investor to break even on their purchase price.
It is a terrifying piece of math. And today, critics take that exact Sun Microsystems speech, they dust it off, and they slap it onto modern AI infrastructure monopolies like NVIDIA.
They do it all the time.
They look at a trailing metric and scream, "NVIDIA is trading at 38 times sales. If 10 times sales was pure insanity in the year 2000, then 38 times sales today means we are in the mother of all bubbles and it's all going to zero."
It's a very compelling narrative if you don't look closer.
Right. But here's where it gets really interesting. Comparing a hardware company in the year 2000 to a modern AI infrastructure monopoly using a raw price-to-sales multiple is a fundamentally flawed, lazy analytical metric.
It is analytically bankrupt because it completely ignores the mechanism of profit margins. And this is exactly where we need to introduce the valuation bridge formula.
Let's pause here for a second. If you're listening and your eyes glaze over at the mention of financial formulas and valuation multiples, stick with us.
We promise to make it painless.
We are going to walk through this step by step conversationally because understanding this specific piece of math is the single most important concept for understanding why the stock market is behaving the way it is right now.
The valuation bridge formula is elegantly simple. It basically states that a company's price-to-earnings ratio, its PE multiple, which is how the market values its actual profits, is equal to its price-to-sales ratio divided by its net margin.
PE equals PS divided by net margin.
Exactly. What this formula proves is that a price-to-sales multiple tells you absolutely nothing useful unless you also know exactly how many of those top-line sales dollars actually make it to the bottom line as pure free cash flow.
Let's use an everyday example to make the mechanics of this intuitive. Think about a traditional high-volume grocery store.
Okay, a grocery store.
A grocery store might have a razor-thin net margin of like 1% or 2%.
Right.
They have to sell a massive physical volume of apples, cereal, and milk, pay for the building, the cashiers, the spoilage, just to make 2 pennies of pure profit on every single dollar they take in.
Right, very tough business.
Very tough. If you were foolish enough to pay 10 times gross sales for a grocery store, you would be paying an astronomical multi-hundred multiple on their actual earnings. It would be a catastrophic investment.
You lose your shirt.
Exactly. But the tech giants driving the AI boom are not grocery stores.
Why not?
They are operating with elite, historically unprecedented free cash flow margins of 60% to 72%.
And the mechanism of a 70% margin fundamentally alters the math of valuation entirely. When a company converts 70 cents of every single dollar of revenue into pure, unencumbered free cash flow, the traditional warning signs distort.
Let's run the math on it.
Let's do it. Let's run the bridge formula on a modern AI giant. If an AI company with a 65% net margin is trading at a seemingly terrifying 20 times sales multiple, you just divide 20 by 0.65. What the math reveals is that the 20x sales multiple is actually only a 28x to 33x earnings multiple.
And a 28x cash flow multiple for a globally dominant monopoly that is growing its revenue at frontier tech rates, that is not a bubble.
No, not at all.
It is a completely reasonable, perhaps even historically average valuation for a high-performance engine. People are mispricing the asset because they are looking at the raw exhaust of the sales number instead of the actual horsepower of the cash flow margin.
Let's apply this reality check directly to the poster child of the AI boom, NVIDIA.
The big one.
Yeah. If we look at the forward consensus estimates from Wall Street analysts for NVIDIA's fiscal year 2027, the projections are just staggering. The consensus models project $391 billion in revenue, accompanied by an astonishing 119% growth in free cash flow.
Those numbers are wild.
They are. And when you measure those projected 2027 numbers against NVIDIA's current market capitalization, the stock is actually trading closer to 13 times forward sales.
13 times forward sales. And if we apply their elite net margins to that 13x figure using the bridge formula we just learned,
it translates to a forward earnings multiple in the mid-20s. Now let's put a mid-20s PE into some historical context here.
Let's hear it.
Over the last decade, NVIDIA's average forward PE has been 36x. Over the last 5 years, their average forward PE has been 41x. So at a mid-20s forward PE, NVIDIA is actually trading at a significant measurable discount to its own historical averages, despite generating the most massive growth in corporate history.
This specific piece of math basically breaks people's brains.
I know, it's counterintuitive.
Because NVIDIA's stock price has gone up roughly 14 times since ChatGPT launched into the public consciousness back in late 2022, it has literally minted millionaires. And yet, mechanically, its PE multiple, how expensive the stock actually is relative to its profits, has gone down.
Because the denominator of the equation, the actual underlying earnings and free cash flow generated by selling the chips, is growing even faster than the stock price is appreciating. The business engine is literally outrunning the hype.
Which is incredible.
But the psychological block for retail investors, and frankly, even for many seasoned institutional investors, is the sheer visceral size of the market capitalization numbers.
I mean, I get it. It's financial vertigo. When a single company hits a $3, $4, or $5 trillion market cap, it triggers a primal fear in the human brain. We are just not wired to process trillions.
We really aren't.
People see a $5 trillion valuation and their brain immediately categorizes it as a dangerous bubble, rather than sitting down with a calculator, looking at the $391 billion in revenue, applying the 70% margins, and running the basic PE math.
Yeah, they see the big number and they panic.
Like, to use an analogy, it's not a dangerous bubble stock. It's just a completely reasonable 28x cash flow multiple wearing a scary price to sales costume for Halloween. As long as the structural cash flows support the valuation, the absolute height of the market cap isn't the real problem.
That being said, we must acknowledge that the stock market is a fundamentally brutal environment.
Oh, absolutely.
Not every company survives, and a rising tide does not permanently lift all boats. Which brings us to our final core exploration, surviving the graveyard. Because in investing, successfully avoiding the catastrophic losers is mathematically just as important as finding the generational winners.
We have to understand the baseline brutality of the public markets. There is a famous, heavily cited 2018 study by a finance professor named Hendrik Bessembinder. He analyzed comprehensive stock market data going all the way back to 1926.
It's an incredible study.
It is. And what he discovered is genuinely shocking to most casual investors. He found that roughly the best performing 4% of publicly listed companies accounted for all of the net U.S. stock market wealth creation above what you would have made just holding risk-free treasury bills.
Think about the implications of that.
It's sobering.
It really is. The other 96% of stocks in the market collectively over their entire lifetimes did no better than holding cash in a basic savings bond. The wealth creation is hyper-concentrated in a tiny fraction of elite compounders.
And it gets even scarier when you look at the downside risk. JP Morgan conducted a massive historical study called The Agony and Ecstasy of Investing. They analyzed the historical drawdowns of individual stocks.
And the agony part is very real.
Very real. They found that roughly 40% to 44% of all stocks suffer catastrophic peak-to-trough declines of 70% or more, and they never recover.
Never.
They crash, the business model breaks, and they stay down forever. They become permanent capital destruction.
This is what we call the 44% graveyard. And the only analytical way to avoid ending up in that bucket of permanent loss is to apply a ruthless, uncompromising quality filter to your investments.
What does that filter look like in practice?
Well, if you study the history of the greatest investors, people like Ben Graham, Joel Greenblatt, Peter Lynch, and Charlie Munger, despite their different styles, they all gravitated toward the exact same defensive business characteristics.
Which are?
To survive market panics, you need a company with durable, consistently high returns on invested capital. You need fortress-like balance sheets with more cash than debt. And crucially, you need structural moats competitive advantages that physically prevent rivals from entering your space and eating your profit margins. Quality is the only reliable mathematical shield against catastrophic permanent capital impairment.
Let's ground this theory in a specific, highly relevant recent case study from the source material. Microsoft.
Perfect example.
Leading into March of 2026, the broader market experienced a severe correction, and Microsoft's stock fell by roughly 34%. Now, for a retail investor watching their portfolio value drop by a third in a matter of weeks, the natural emotional instinct is absolute panic.
The flight or fight response completely kicks in.
Right. They think, the AI bubble just popped. Get me out before it goes to zero. But how does an investor applying that strict quality filter look at that exact same 34% drop?
They systematically look right past the flashing red ticker price, and they examine the underlying mechanics of the business engine. During that period where the stock fell 34%, Microsoft's long-term cash return on invested capital remained completely intact at approximately 20%.
It didn't flinch.
Not at all. The fundamental mechanism of a company, its ability to generate cash from its operations, was operating flawlessly. But because of the broader emotional panic in the market, Microsoft's forward valuation multiple was crushed. It fell from its historical norm of around 35x earnings all the way down to 19x earnings.
So you have a AAA rated company, dominating global enterprise software, deeply entrenched in global cloud infrastructure, growing its underlying cash flows at 20% a year, and suddenly, just because of market fear, it goes on sale for nearly half its historical multiple.
This scenario perfectly illustrates Ben Graham's foundational concept of the stock market.
The voting machine versus the weighing machine.
Exactly. In the short term, the market acts as a voting machine, driven entirely by human emotion, fear, greed, and popularity. But in the long term, over years and decades, the market acts as a weighing machine, driven purely by the undeniable gravity of actual cash flows.
That makes total sense.
When a high-quality, impenetrable moat like Microsoft drops 34% while all its underlying business metrics remain perfectly stable, the correct analytical question to ask is never, is the stock down?
What should you ask?
The only question that matters to a quality investor is the business broken? If the answer is no, you are not looking at a bubble popping. You are looking at a rare, highly lucrative valuation anomaly.
And the math on exploiting these specific anomalies is just incredible. The sources detail that if you buy a high-quality stock at a 50% discount to its historical fair value, and you simply hold it, waiting for the market's weighing machine to eventually return it to its normal historical multiple over, say, a 30-year period.
The normalization process is powerful.
It is, because that gradual normalization alone adds roughly a 2.35% annualized valuation tailwind to your overall returns.
And while 2.35% might sound like a pretty small marginal gain to some people, the power of compound interest over decades is profound. That specific valuation tailwind generates more excess return, more absolute alpha, than the absolute best elite active fund managers on Wall Street were able to generate over the last 20 years.
It's staggering.
You basically achieve market-beating, generational returns simply by identifying durable quality and aggressively buying it when the broader market has a temporary emotional panic attack.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener?
It highlights a huge paradox.
Right. Because it highlights a fascinating paradox in human behavior and institutional finance. If buying a AAA-rated cash machine like Microsoft at a 34% discount is such an obvious, historically validated, mathematically sound strategy, why isn't everyone doing it?
Why indeed?
Why wasn't Berkshire Hathaway, with portfolio managers sitting on hundreds of billions of dollars in cash, buying Microsoft with both hands during that 34% drop?
That is the multi-billion dollar behavioral question right there.
Mm-hmm.
And it proves that even the most elite institutional giants can be paralyzed by broad market psychology.
They get scared too.
They do. Or they can be constrained by their own rigid historical mandate structures that just prevent them from buying technology companies. Or they simply might be psychologically unwilling to pay what looks like a high absolute multiple, say 19x earnings, even if that multiple is deeply discounted relative to the company's specific hypergrowth trajectory.
It's fascinating.
It is a profound lesson in the investment process. True value investing and high growth investing are not opposing philosophies. In these rare moments of market dislocation, they shake hands. Identifying durable, high-margin quality and having the sheer psychological fortitude to sit on your hands and wait for market panic to compress the multiple is the ultimate edge in investing.
The edge isn't having faster information. The edge is having the conviction to actually sit down and do the math when everyone else is just reacting to the terrifying headlines.
Well said.
Okay, we have covered an immense amount of ground today. Let's just recap exactly what we've unpacked here. We started by measuring the physical highway. We looked at the massive 190 gigawatt pipeline of global AI infrastructure, and we identified that it is fundamentally constrained by the physics of a 5 to 7 year power grid connection bottleneck.
Right. And from there, we established the physical revenue ceiling.
Yeah.
We used Anthropic's real-world $15 billion per gigawatt conversion rate to calculate a staggering $3.3 trillion to $6.8 trillion annual revenue potential by 2030. We then ran the execution test. We proved mathematically that even against aggressive multi-trillion dollar hurdles, the industry only needs to successfully monetize about 13% to 39% of that physical capacity to completely justify the current multi-billion dollar spend.
Then we looked at the actual profits hitting the bank today, validating that the hyperscalers are already achieving their historical 20% returns on invested capital because they are building into the safety of contracted scarcity.
Which led us to the multiples.
Exactly. We used the valuation bridge formula to pull the scary price-to-sales mask off the high-margin compounders, revealing completely reasonable, structurally sound earnings multiples. And finally, we use historical market data to show that applying a strict quality filter is the only mathematical way to avoid the 44% of stocks that go to the graveyard and permanently destroy wealth.
It all comes back to establishing a structured, rational framework built on physics and cash flow rather than vibes and headlines.
Couldn't agree more.
But before we sign off, if we connect everything we've discussed today, there is one final provocative angle to all of this that we haven't touched on yet.
Oh, lay it on us.
Well, we spent a lot of time establishing that the primary bottleneck to the entire AI revolution is the national power grid, right? Which takes up to 7 years to connect.
Yes, the huge wait time.
At the same time, we established that successfully controlling and monetizing this compute capacity represents a multi-trillion dollar economic upside for the victors.
Right. The economic incentive to solve the power problem is almost unimaginably large. It is the literal gold rush of our generation.
So this raises a vital question about the future of global infrastructure. If the economic upside is measured in the trillions and the primary bottleneck is a slow, aging national grid managed by local zoning boards, how long until the hyperscalers simply stop waiting for permission?
What do you mean?
Could we see a future where these massive tech giants use their unlimited capital to completely bypass national infrastructure? Imagine the rise of what we might call sovereign tech states companies, deciding to build and operate their own independent, small, modular nuclear reactors to power their data centers completely off the grid.
Wow.
Or imagine massive floating oceanic data centers operating in international waters, cooled by the ocean and powered by offshore assets, completely free from local zoning laws. They have the trillions in cash required, and they have the absolute financial incentive to do it.
That's intense.
We might currently be watching the birth of corporate entities that fundamentally become more powerful, self-sustaining utilities than the very sovereign governments that currently attempt to regulate them.
Floating, self-contained data centers powered by private corporate nuclear reactors and international waters. I mean, that fundamentally changes the definition of what a technology company even is.
It really does.
It moves them from software vendors to global nation states. That is an incredible thought to chew on as we watch this infrastructure build out continue over the next few years.
Lots to think about.
We want to warmly thank you for taking this deep dive with us today. The numbers in this space are massive, and they are designed to induce financial vertigo. But remember, the absolute best defense against market panic and the clearest way to spot a true generational opportunity is simply taking a breath, looking past the headlines, and doing the math. Until next time.